A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. No news from the Supreme Court. Well, I shouldn't say that. They did deny cert to a case called Westforth Sports versus Illinois. This is a case dealing with an Indiana gun store that was sued by the city of Chicago because a number of handguns that it sold ended up being traced in the state of Illinois, and the city of Chicago sued. The question that was presented to the court, fairly technical, but essentially the Supreme Court turned away that challenge. So the judgment of an Illinois appellate court against the Indiana gun store will stand. Nothing, though, on the five hardware cases that have been pending before the Supreme Court for months now. I think Gators Custom Guns versus Washington, which is a magazine ban challenge, Duncan versus Bada. Believe those have been listed for 14 conferences without the Supreme Court taking action. Then you've got the so-called Asoapin cases, Viramontes versus Cook County, and then two challenges to Connecticut's ban on so-called assault weapons. Once again, the Supreme Court not turning away those cases, not granting cert in those cases, just holding on to those cases as they've been holding on to a number of cases dealing with bans on sales or bans on carrying of firearms for adults under the age of 21. Now, those age-related cases have not been discussed in conference for months, so it is everybody's best guess that the Supreme Court holding on to those cases will grant cert, vacate the lower court decision, remand those cases back down to the lower courts after its rulings in Wolford versus Lopez, or perhaps the case dealing with the federal prohibition on gun ownership for unlawful uses of drugs, the Hamani case, neither of which really deal with that particular issue. So it is possible that the Supreme Court would just deny cert altogether to those cases, but it seems weird that they wouldn't have done so already if that were going to be the case. The expectation still with the hardware ban cases is that the court is waiting on the Third Circuit to release its decision in Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs versus then Attorney General Matt Plotkin. This is a challenge to the Garden State's gun ban. And ban on quote-unquote large-capacity magazines. Oral arguments were held at this point almost 7 months ago. So we don't know why the Supreme Court hasn't, or excuse me, why the Third Circuit has not released its decision, unless perhaps the dissenting judges are slow-walking their dissent and keeping the court from issuing a majority opinion that, again, would strike down New Jersey's assault weapon ban and large capacity ban, at least to some large degree. So we're playing the waiting game once again. Meanwhile, also no news in the Federal Register regarding the 34 rules that the ATF wants to put in place, most of which deal with firearms, both repealing Biden-era rules, putting in place some new rules, protections for gun owners under the Firearm Owners Protection Act, rules for the firearm industry as well. And I said last week that once we had the actual text of these rules, wanted to sit down with John Comerford from NRA ILA. Well, I had the opportunity to talk with John on Friday, unfortunately, before, again, these rules have been released. But still thought it was a great conversation, wanted to share with you. And when we do actually see these rules published in the Federal Register, which is the next step to have these rules formally put in place, once we've had time to go through the text of all of these rules, I do want to do a deep dive here on the program, maybe even with new ATF Director Robert Sakata, who I anticipate will be joining us here in the next couple of weeks. But today we did have the opportunity to sit down with John Comerford, NRA ILA Executive Director, to discuss some of the proposed rules here, at least the broad strokes of these proposed rules. Take a look and a listen. John, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's good to see you again.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you bet. I was hoping that we would see these proposed rules in the Federal Register before you and I had a chance to talk, so we could actually look at the text of these things, but unfortunately that has not happened yet. You're a busy guy. I'm a busy guy. So I figured, well, let's talk while we can, because who knows when we're going to get the chance to do this again. So let me just get your impression. I mean, you were there at ATF headquarters on Wednesday, and you know, you got to see and hear from Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche, mm-hmm. from a newly confirmed ATF Director Robert Sakata, and you yep. got to hear about these new rules. What is your impression of what the DOJ and ATF is doing here?
Well, look, I think first you have to look at kind of the fresh take on respecting the Second Amendment that we're seeing from Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche. He wasted no time getting this done. You know, NRA sent over a 34-page memo back in 2025 after the president's executive order related to items we would like to see ATF address in restoring these rights and getting rid of these harassments from the Biden years. And here we are. It's, you know, now May 1st in 2026, but he's only been on the job a few weeks, and we see him moving full steam ahead. And we saw him talking about a few of these things at our annual meeting in Houston recently, along with Rob Sakata. So I think the fact that DOJ took it as serious as they did, they invited lots of stakeholders to DOJ yesterday. And it wasn't just guns, even though the smoking gun put out a story labeling all of us, which I'm probably going to print on canvas and hang in the office because it's a pretty neat looking graphic. There's even a guy from the explosives industry there, and I had to message him and say, you made it under the radar because they're not looking at the explosives industry. So it was great to see, but you know how this goes. The devils will be in the details. So we're going to have to wait and see when they're in the register and dig into it and make sure everything's right. And if it's not right, you know, we'll make sure we point that out in our comments.
Well, that's the thing, right? So you've got this public comment period, and that's exactly what this is for, you know, so we can recommend changes. You know, we saw this back when DOJ announced the rights restoration process, something that, you know, I think we're all very pleased about in general. But when the actual rule was published, I know NRA said, hey, here's some things we think that could be done better. Yeah. Here are some concerns that we have. And, you know, it may very well be the case that some of these rules, you know, your organization, other organizations, individual gun owners can offer, you know, a constructive criticism, let's say, right, to make those rules even better.
Yeah, and I think looking at this particular tranche that they're going to release, which is the potentially the largest in ATF's history, I know it's the most rules actually combined over decades. Rob Leiter, ATF's counsel, you know, was central in working on this. And for those listeners that know Rob, you know he is a very accomplished Second Amendment academic, and probably the only true Second Amendment professor that was studying from a scholarly basis in a law school just this issue. So the fact that they drafted him to come over to the team, and thanks to Rob for being willing to do it. Because, look, you know, you saw some of our friends who criticize ATF at every turn were there taking selfies with the new ATF director while their Twitter was criticizing ATF at the same time. So, you know, it's not an easy place to work. It's hard to make everyone happy. But I think Rob has done a good job. We'll see how thorough everything is. I expect it will be. And, yeah, we'll be there. Just like you pointed out on restoration of rights, we'll be there, and our great team of research attorneys led by Chris Zeelan. I know he's itching to dig in, and we're not shy about sending the comments back.
So I want to ask, and again, we don't have the text of the actual rule, but one of the proposals that has generated a lot of interest regarding non-over-the-counter sales of firearms. I don't know if you've had a chance to read this summary, but the way most folks are reading the summary is that this would allow for gun owners to purchase firearms from a in-state FFL without having to go there in person, still go through the background check, right? Still fill out the 4473, but you don't have to travel there in person, and you could have that firearm shipped directly to your home. Is that the way you read the summary of that particular rule, John?
Yeah, this had been rumored for a few weeks now. It came up really at our annual meeting. There were some in the industry that got wind of this. And, you know, I think for the listeners out there, let's start with, if you've bought a suppressor from, let's say, Silencer Central, okay, this is the best way I can explain the process. You know, you buy that suppressor, you go through, you do the same process as you would at a dealer, but it gets mailed to your house and there's adult signature required. And I remember when Brandon kind of revolutionized the industry, when he got a determination letter from ATF allowing that, it's a similar type of process that they're looking at for firearm sales. Now, I think this is going to be fairly controversial in even in the industry, right? So you have, is that going to lead to more manufacturer direct sales if they operate as the FFL? As how does that impact distributors, mom and pop shops, and then the process in general? Because sometimes the Postal Service can be less than reliable. So even though I love my mailman, he's on time every day. So I think the devil's in the details again on that, and we're going to have to, you know, wait and see until everything is laid out there exactly how this will work, how they're interpreting it will work. But it's, you know, it's exciting to see this level of creativity being applied. And I think that's where you see someone like Rob Leiter is using his immense experience and applying it to these changes.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is one of the rule changes that have been proposed that the anti-gunners have absolutely fixated on, along with the repeal of the engaged in the business rule. Although, you know, it should be noted that, because they're not talking about it, that rule had already been subject to an injunction by a federal judge. I mean, NRA Eiley reported on that last fall, right? And the Trump administration was not enforcing that rule. Now it goes back to at least under the proposed rule, it goes back to the statutory language that was approved by Congress, right? This mm-hmm. was the problem. The Biden administration took that statutory language and then went beyond what Congress had said in terms of who is engaged in the business. There was still that language about, you know, if you make an occasional sale or transfer, if you sell a gun from your personal collection, you're not a dealer. But the Biden administration said, yeah, you probably are, right?
Yeah. It's, you know, it was the typical harassment that we saw from the Biden administration, right? We saw zero tolerance for dealers, even on extremely minor clerical errors. So you're seeing some changes in this too on the willful side of things. You have to show a willful regard for not following the rules and regs or the law. But yeah, this with engaged in the business, I mean, you're taking, you know, minor hobbyists, individuals who just want to dispose of some of their collection or they want to upgrade. There's always something new coming out. I mean, look at our friends at Kel-Tec. They're coming out with things we never thought were possible on a weekly basis, it seems. So I think this just shows they're getting back to interpreting the law the way it should be. Congress makes laws. We might not agree with all of them. But ATF, for far too long, you know, we saw this on braces, right? How many times do we see this issue seesaw back and forth? And every time it's seesawed, we're talking about people, tens of millions of people that could go to jail for these things based on a regulatory determination, not a change in Congress. So it's encouraging to see, and we'll dig into this. I mean, I really want to dig into the FOPA piece that they put in there with kind of standard deviation and recognizing that. You know, I grew up in New Jersey. Anyone who's driven through New Jersey knows if you're going to be protected by FOPA, you better fuel up at one bridge before you cross in. And God forbid you have a flat tire. If you do, you know, you better hold a white flag out your window and you're running up the turnpike on the rim because you can't deviate. Right. So this provides for that. And then it opens up the window to, you know, the enforcement or the entrapment mechanism that they've set up at the Port Authority airports, where someone, you know, their plane has to deviate to that airport for a maintenance issue or a storm, and you get stuck overnight. You pick up your bag with your handgun. You have no idea. You just think you're going to go to your hotel, and then they arrest you. Yeah. And take your gun. So I think these are really encouraging things to get back to where the Second Amendment should be, and not treating it like a second class right, like the Biden administration did.
Well, and, you know, I mean, again, echoing one of the comments from Todd Blanche, right? He said, you shouldn't have to have a law degree to know how to exercise your rights. I think he's absolutely spot on with that. Now, again, we look at the plain text of the Second Amendment and say it doesn't take a law degree to understand shall not be infringed. But, we don't live in a world where, no rules or regulations exist. We can work towards that goal, but... we are going to have to live, I think, in the reality that that exists today. And so we are going to have to deal with rules and regulations. We are going to have to deal with the fact that the ATF, as you say, does not create laws. I mean, I've heard people say, this isn't good enough. They didn't get rid of the NFA. Well, the ATF can't get rid of the NFA, right? I mean, there is only so much the ATF can do. But what this does, it's sort of what we hope that this does and what it sounds like the ATF is trying to do here and DOJ is trying to do is, as you say, color within the lines, right?
Yeah.
Not go beyond what Congress has laid out. And, you talk about the pistol brace rule. I mean, this is something where, again, we're going to need to see the fine print, right? Because we know that the DOJ had said, okay, we're done with the pistol brace interpretation of, every brace-equipped pistol is a short-barreled firearm. But in court filings, we've seen DOJ say, but in some cases, they still might be, right? So it is going to take, I think, careful examination of what these proposed rules look like. And again, very important for folks to comment during that public comment period that's coming up.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, ATF has a long way to go to restore its reputation. They may never be able to restore the reputation of the agency, but I think they are making a valiant effort here to try to respect the rights of gun owners, create rules and regulations that follow the law that are more easily interpreted. But look, I mean, there's plenty in the gun community who continue to say abolish ATF. Well, I hate to break it to you. If you abolish ATF tomorrow, I mean, how are you going to purchase a firearm? There's a lot of things that they do that are critical. That if you're getting rid of ATF, some of that enforcement mechanism is going to be absorbed somewhere else.
Right.
It will never just go away. And I can understand the desire for it to just go away, but that's not in political reality. So we operate within reality. And I say trust, but verify. Trust they have the best in their mind towards gun owners, but verify and stay tuned to the process, whether that's through the Federal Register, that's, checking out NRAILA.org and following each step. And I encourage folks to go to the ILA website and look at that memo. We link to it right in this story about these regs, just to see how much needed to be fixed. I mean, even if you scroll through to see 34 pages, and we did include reopening the machine gun amnesty. They didn't do that one, but hey, we're going to keep asking.
Well, Todd Blanche did say that this was the first round of reform. So I hope that you will keep pushing that. I hope that we do see some continued reforms. I know that Blanche mentioned looking at the sporting purposes language and the firearms that are allowed to be imported under that language. And, it sure sounded like he was talking about expanding that body of firearms, not restricting the body of firearms that can be imported. So I think that there is a desire, and I kind of echoing what you said earlier, it really does seem like the Second Amendment and getting the support of gun owners has been a big priority for Todd Blanche during the short time that he has been acting Attorney General. Again, going to the NRA annual meeting, making himself available to talk with folks who are on the Voices of the Second Amendment media row. That alone, I think, is significant, particularly, there were a lot of complaints that Pam Bondi wasn't doing enough, that she, was sort of paying lip service to the Second Amendment. I think Todd Blanche has been very much boots on the ground, and has made this it hasn't been a one-off, right? This has been a sort of a continued series of actions that we've seen from the acting Attorney General while he's been in that position.
Yeah, Attorney General Bondi, I mean, we weren't her focus, right? I didn't really see her do anything overtly wrong towards our space outside of some of these initial filings where we saw Biden hold over career attorneys, like in the NFA case, right? We're very upset with those filings. We made that known. We'll see if they change their position going forward. But we didn't see her really engage very much on this issue. And you see Todd Blanche come into the role, and hopefully he'll be around for a long time, because we see immediate engagement and in the right way to clean things up, to listen to the staff over there who were put in their roles to undo the wrongs of the Biden administration. So encouraging to see. And yeah, I think his commitment being at our show for two full days, essentially walking the floor, being accessible, shows a lot, and it shows a real commitment. And, you know, it helps. It certainly helps that his mother-in-law owns Checkmate magazines, and she's been coming to our show for 30 years. She was at the signing the other day. So don't discount domestic pressure to help keep somebody pro-gun.
That's right. Well, John, listen, again, I appreciate you carving out a few minutes. Would love to touch base with you again. Once these rules have been published in the Federal Register, we've all had a chance to read the fine print and go through this stuff. But in the meantime, again, thanks for being here today. Thanks for all you do.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Always happy to be here.
My thanks to John for joining us on the program. Looking forward to having him back again soon. And still looking forward to doing that deep dive into the rules once the Federal Register releases the actual text of the almost three dozen rules. They're signed by Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche last week. Right now, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a case out of California that I guess isn't really a recidivist report, but it is a what the heck are they thinking story, and maybe just an example of California's soft on crime policies. Friends get probation for robbery and elder abuse. And this is just a bizarre story. The High Desert Star reports that just about 2 weeks after this crime was committed, it's already been resolved in court, which alone is significant because, I mean, typically these cases take months, if not years, to resolve. But 62-year-old Winnie McBride, 40-year-old Scott Kaufman were arrested, I think, on April 14th, the day before April 13th. The pair allegedly stole property from a 35-year-old man's residence. When he confronted them, they fled, and they allegedly intentionally hit the victim with their vehicle. So again, the next day, deputies have a search warrant for the home where McBride and Kaufman live. They show up there. They find the property that was taken. But they also found an 80-year-old woman who the sheriff's department described as being in a severely compromised condition, saying that she was in a state of extreme neglect, malnourished, without care, and in urgent need of immediate medical intervention. She was related to one of the suspects. They didn't say which one because they wanted to protect her privacy. She was taken to the High Desert Medical Center. Meanwhile, McBride was taken to the local jail where she was booked on suspicion of armed robbery, assault with a deadly weapon, and elder abuse. Kaufman was booked on suspicion of robbery. Apparently, McBride was behind the wheel of the car at the time. But the DA's office only charged McBride with felony elder abuse and misdemeanor grand theft. So the allegation that she intentionally hit the victim of the theft as she was fleeing the scene, DA decided not to do anything with it at all. Kaufman booked on charged with a misdemeanor grand theft. That's it. And then I guess either some deal was offered. In fact, I'm almost assured that some deal was offered here because McBride ends up pleading no contest on April 30th. Kaufman pleads no contest as well. McBride, who again originally was charged with armed robbery, assault with a deadly weapon, and elder abuse, she pleads no contest to felony elder abuse and misdemeanor grand theft. She gets a sentence of 32 days in jail, but she's told that she can actually serve that sentence doing work release. So, is that really 32 days in jail? She also got 5 years of felony probation. Kaufman, who also had his charges downgraded to misdemeanor grand theft, was sentenced to 8 days in jail with credit for 4 days served and then 4 days time off for good behavior. So he's essentially done. He got a year of probation, which is interesting. According to the High Desert Star, he was sentenced to 1 year of felony probation, even though he pleaded no contest to a misdemeanor charge. So I'm not even sure how that works. But I'm also not sure why the prosecutor would have offered such a deal in the first place. I mean, again, even if there, let's say there were, you know, evidentiary issues with whether or not the DA's office could prove that McBride intentionally hit the victim of the theft as she was driving away. Based solely on what the sheriff's office said about the condition of this 80-year-old woman, and I know that they were trying to protect her privacy, but given that McBride was the one facing felony elder abuse charges, I'm guessing that it was her relative. Based on her condition, right? Extreme neglect, malnourished, without care, an urgent need of immediate medical intervention. Why would the prosecutor accept this offer to plead no contest? Why would they extend an offer that would essentially result in nothing more than probation? Maybe they wanted to spare the victim from testifying, but I don't know that would have been necessary, to be honest. You've got the deputies who showed up there at the scene who could describe the condition that the woman was in. You've got medical professionals who would have treated her at the hospital who could describe the extent of the neglect and the abuse. It rubs me the wrong way that an 80-year-old woman suffered like this, and the person who, again, by pleading no contest, did not acknowledge guilt, but did admit that, yeah, there's enough evidence to convict me. So the person who, you know, essentially accepted responsibility for this, or at least accepted that a jury would have been likely to convict her, the fact that she gets away with nothing more than probation and a few days of work release, you know, essentially community service, really, really rubs me the wrong way. And this isn't, Los Angeles County. It's not San Francisco. It's part of California you'd think would be a little bit more conservative, but apparently not when it comes to punishing elder abuse. Just as I said, a disturbing story all around. Today's Armed Citizen story from Nashville, Tennessee, where an attempted burglar was shot and injured after breaking into an apartment on Saturday night. The suspect actually knew the victim, although the victim says he was not aware that he knew the suspect at the time. It was about 10:30 Saturday evening. 56-year-old man in the bedroom of his apartment, just watching TV, when all of a sudden guy walks in wearing like a medical mask and demands money. That suspect later identified as 45-year-old Derek Mercer. The 56-year-old grabbed a gun that was by his side, but Mercer then jumped across the bed, tried to grab the gun, wrestle it away from the victim. During the struggle, a shot was fired that struck Mercer in the chest. According to the Metro Nashville Police Department, the 56-year-old man told police that he did know Mercer, that Mercer had actually been in his home earlier that day, but he didn't realize it was Mercer because he had the mask on. Mercer was able to leave the apartment. He was found by police in the parking lot, taken to a local hospital to be treated. Apparently, he is going to be okay. He declined to be interviewed by police there at the hospital. When he is released, authorities say that he'll be charged with aggravated burglary and unlawful gun possession by a convicted felon, because convicted felons aren't allowed to even touch a gun, even if they're not successful in grabbing it away from their intended victim. That counts, I guess, as unlawful gun possession. We'll see if that survives a potential plea deal. But the victim in this case not facing any charges, acting in self-defense inside his own home. And finally today, our good deed of the day in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A woman in North Phoenix who helped save a man from a burning car just a couple of days ago. According to ArizonaFamily.com, Julie Reed was sitting at a intersection last month in North Phoenix when she saw a car smash into the back of the SUV that was next to her. The impact then sent the SUV flying into the intersection, and the engine compartment quickly started smoking. Reed said she saw the airbags had deployed, but she also saw, again, the smoke coming out from under the hood. So she jumped out of her vehicle. She helped pull the driver out of the SUV. And just a couple of seconds later, boom, the flames you could see from underneath the engine compartment. Julie Reed describes herself as good in a crisis. She said that she stepped in to do exactly what her husband had told her to do. She'd been married to a firefighter for more than two decades. And she said that she used the training that her husband has, kind of drilled into her over the years about the best way to respond in an emergency. She said being able to step in, being able to handle anything that comes your way, I think is a key thing for fire wives and probably police wives, too. She said it was just kind of a surreal experience just being able to see someone else's hero at home step into that light, show up in the ways that I know my husband has done for decades. Well, again, I mean, nothing, taking nothing away from our first responders, but I think we all have it within ourselves, at least theoretically, to respond as Julie Reed did. But again, having that training, if not firsthand experience, having that knowledge base, I think does help you react more quickly in an emergency where others might be frozen. Again, if you've had that sort of drilled into your head about this is what to do, maybe you're less likely to freeze up, more likely to swiftly take action as Julie Reed did in pulling that driver to safety. So in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Julie Reed in Phoenix, Arizona, we thank you for your very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. Looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow on 2A Tuesday. Maybe we'll have some news from the Third Circuit. Maybe we'll have some news from the Federal Register. Either way, we're going to have you covered with the top Second Amendment stories of the day. In fact, you can get more stories at BearingArms.com. And if you like what you see, I would also encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold or VIP Platinum member. Just use the promo code FIGHT, and you can take 60% off your membership. No matter what tier of support you choose, you'll get some great benefits. And no matter what tier of support you choose, you will be supporting the work we're doing at Bearing Arms. And I want to thank you for that. Have a great rest of your Monday, as good as Mondays can be. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.